शान्तिबोधितां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्ब त्वामनुसन्धधामि भगवद्गीते भगवद्वेषिणीम्. We're on verse 35, chapter 11. The last few verses, Krishna was describing his whole Virat Swarupa, but in the most frightening form. And so, in the previous verse, in verse 34, he also mentioned to Arjuna that Drona and Bhishma and Jayadrata and Karna, all of these, this foursome, this group of four were essential for Duryodhana's victory in this war. And so Krishna mentioned these four along with many other very exalted, warriors. He said, all of these people, may you conquer them, these people who have already been killed by me. They've already been destroyed by me because the result of the very karma that brought them here. They're brought into this situation to be destroyed. That's their prarabdha in this situation. So they are already destroyed. May you act, he says, may you act as an anitta. Means may you be the conduit, act as the conduit through which so that all of these things can happen. And then he says, so do that. And then he says, stop shuddering. Stop your quaking. Don't quake. May you fight and be victorious over your enemies in this war. That's what he said after having shown his very frightening form. So now Sanjaya comes in and makes a comment about this, seeing how what Krishna has shown Arjuna and how Arjuna is reacting. Sanjaya has something to say. So it says this. So this is beginning of 35. Sanjaya uvacha, etat shrutva vachanam keshavasya, etat shrutva vachanam keshavasya, kritanjali rve pamanak kriti, namaskritva bhuya evaha krishnam, namaskritva bhuya evaha krishnam, sagadgadam bita bita pranamya, sagadgadam bita bita pranamya. So Sanjaya, remember that Sanjaya is the one who's been given that divya chakshu, that divine eye, to be able to see from a distance the whole war, everything that's transpiring, and along with this dialogue, this very intimate dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. And so Sanjaya is relating this whole thing to Dhritarashtra, who is the father of Duryodhana, and is blind. And so Sanjaya is really kind of the narrator of the whole Bhagavad Gita. Even though within it there's dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, Sanjaya is the one who's actually relating that dialogue. You know, and then sometimes he comes in, once in a while, he comes in with his own voice. So here, there's a Sanjaya's voice coming in. So Sanjaya Uvacha, Sanjaya now says, etat shrutva vachanam keshavasya. He said, having heard these words of Keshava, of Krishna, these words telling him about the outcome of the war, but also revealing, he's heard these words of Krishna about the outcome of the war and how all of these, he sees and hears how all of these people will be destroyed in the war. But he's also, remember, seeing all of these people stuck between the teeth, you know, with that Virat Swarupa, with the mouth of Krishna in this Virat Swarupa open with just death, you know. People being swallowed, all kinds of people pouring into this fiery mouth with these fangs and teeth. So it was very frightening to see. So he says, having heard these words of Keshava, which is named for Krishna, Kritanjalihi Vepamanaha Kiriti. Kiriti comes from Kiritin, the one who is wearing a crown, because Arjuna was a prince. So this is just a name for Arjuna, Kiriti. So the Kiriti, Arjuna, wearing his crown, Vepamanaha, trembling, shaking. Kritanjalihi, his hands, and Kritanjalihi means his hands are like this. This is Kritanjali, where the hands are in this purple, you know, shaking. Namaskritwa Bhuyaha, having bowed to namaskar. Namaskar is, you know, bowing down, like when we do namaskar to our teacher. Namaskritwa Bhuyaha, bowing down again, doing pranams again. Eva Aha Krishnam. Then he says to Krishna, Aha Krishnam. And how does he say it? Sagadgadam. With his voice trembling, his voice faltering, and bita, being filled with fear. Bita means being afraid. Bita means really being afraid. The fear is coming and going and coming and going. You know, it's not just one little bout of fear, but it's a rising fear and rising fear. Shankara in his commentary does a little bit of description about this, and so does Swamiji relating to this in his commentary talks about it. Well, Arjuna is both terrified by what he's seeing and also totally overwhelmed with the awe of the whole thing, and so his eyes are watering his hairs are standing on end with herpulation, but it's both from being totally overwhelmed and amazed, and at the same time being totally frightened. So at the same time that he's feeling overwhelmed and tremendous kind of joy and absorption, at the same time he's feeling tremendous fear, and so his throat is choking up, and he's really unable to speak, his voice becomes quiet and faltering. So that's his situation. One's a conflicted situation, one of being scared to death, and at the same time overwhelmed and feeling in total awe and wonder and joy. So here with his voice faltering and being filled with fear and pranamya, again pranaming, so it says, first he does namaskars, he does, you know, salutations like this, and then he bows down, pranamya, he does prostrations, filled with fear, and then in that state he says this. And so now we go back to Arjuna's voice. He says, Arjuna uvacha, stane hrishikesha tava prakirtya, stane hrishikesha tava prakirtya, jagat prahrishyat anurajyate cha, jagat prahrishyat anurajyate cha, rakshamsi bhitani dishodravanti, Urakshasi bhitani dishodravanti, sarve namasyanti cha siddhasangaha, sarve namasyanti cha siddhasangaha. He says, hey Hrishikesha. Hrishikesha means the one who has control over their sense organs. So it's just an address to Krishna, a name that Krishna is often referred to as Hrishikesha. So stani means it's an indeclinable. It means in this situation it's appropriate, this is proper, it is proper in this reality, in the situation as things are, stane, it is proper, hey Vishikesha. Tava prakirtya, by prakirti means to verbally adore, like Swamiji will say, like to sing praises, you know, or to recite poetry all in praise of you. So if you say in the instrumental, by singing your praises, meaning all of the different songs and stotras and suktas that are written in praise of Ishvara, all of these praises and all of these shlokas and suktas that are written to glorifying you and your nature, all of these are so appropriate. All of these kirtis, prakirtis, are so they're appropriate for you. So by these kirtis of you, jagat, the whole world, prahrishyati, the whole world, the jagat, the people, right, they rejoice. They rejoice, not only they rejoice, but anurajyate, they also love you. They're also, anuraj means to love or to be devoted, just as like with your, say with your guru, with your teacher, the one who's given, say the one who has given you this knowledge, or your ishta devata, the devata that you invoke, that you have a special relationship with, there's a love and a bhakti, a devotion for that form, either for the guru or for the form of the Lord or whatever, whatever being evokes that type of love. Here it's for Ishvara himself, for Krishna. You know, you, the whole world singing these praises to you, you know, they rejoice. They rejoice in your form. They feel love for you. They rejoice and they feel love. Some of them do. Okay. So those by praising you, by praising your form, by feeling that they feel that the world feels that love and devotion for you. And but then he says, Rakshamsi Bhitani, but the Rakshasas means the Adharmis, the ones who are caught in Adharma or have a tendency. The Asuras and the Rakshasas and the Rakshasas, the Asuras are overwhelmed, those type of demons, beings that are overwhelmed by tamas. So they're very dull. And the Rakshasas are overwhelmed by rajas, so they're very active, angry, you know. But they have a tendency toward adharma. So those that have a tendency toward adharma or follow adharmic pathways to fulfill their desires, those rakshamsi, those type of people, bitani, being filled with fear, they're bitani, filled with fear, they run in haste, dravanti, means quickly running. They quickly run dishaha. Disha means in all directions. They run away from you in all directions. They flee you because they're because of their fear of the natural results of a dharma. You know, it's like, and Swamiji uses an example of if you have fire, fire, if it's treated properly, if the fire is understood what it is, and it's handled properly, it does so much good. It can cook for you, it can warm you, it can turn things, it can turn wood into charcoal. So many things that it can do that is so useful. It can even clear the brush. So fire, when it's understood, is so helpful. But when fire is misunderstood or the laws of the fire are not known, it can be very terrifying. It can burn you. It can destroy villages. It can destroy and burn and hurt and maim. And so like that, the universe, with all of its laws, if the laws are understood and respected, then they bless you. And then you rejoice and sing and love Bhagawan because of, from those blessings. But they can also, the laws of the universe, if they're not understood, you can be hurt by them because you're not understanding how the law works. And so, for instance, if you think that you can just fulfill your desire no matter what the consequences, you'll find out that that isn't true. That you may fulfill the desire, but the price you pay along the way, you know, because you've made bad choices in the fulfillment of the desire, you know, you'll be punished, will feel like a punishment. Punishment, when we say I'm being punished, and often we anthropomorphize Bhagawan in that way as the one who gives, you know, gives rewards and also gives punishment. And even the Buddha goes through the one who rewards and the one who punishes. We say that because the laws reward and punish, right? If we are sensitive to the laws, like we in the Hinduism, they'll say the whole Veda, the whole Karmakanda, the first portion of the Vedas is this big, and the last portion of the Vedanta is this big, or this big. You know, this talks about just the reality, the nature of things. This talks about this creation, like a man. It's like a manual. Or how to be in this creation. What is dharma? What is adharma? What are your duties as a human being? What is it? What are the duties for you as you go through life? Now, some of these dharmas, you can say, some of these dharmas are just specific to Hinduism and they have to be translated to other cultures. But many of the dharmas are what we call, they're just the sadharana dharmas. They're dharmas which are applicable to all human beings, you know. And so those dharmas, though, they have to be understood, and you have to have a value for them, a value for values. That's why Swamiji's book, The Value of Values, is such a beautiful book, because it makes you not just take a given dharma that has been passed down through the centuries in every religion and in every spiritual practice. There's certain dharmas that have been, you know, or ways of behavior that have been passed down in every single religion and in many, many spiritual disciplines. In that class I teach, Eastern Theories of Self-Mind and Nature, I line up the dharmas that are listed in Buddhism, in Sankhya Yoga, in Vedanta, and I just run through, there's that, all the way through. And then you go into the Western religions, they're there, all the way through. And so, if this is the wisdom, it's a wisdom that has held the test of time and has been passed down through every religion, every philosophical discipline. It's in psychology, all of these things, because this is what people have discovered. But once something is discovered and it becomes like a law, like thou shalt not kill is a rule. And then unless you have a value for the reason for that rule, it's just rote. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not dishonor thy parents, all of these things, these Ten Commandments, they're just looked at as it rules without realizing the dharma involved and what the price you pay for the breaking of that rule. The terrible psychological trauma that you have to suffer through the breaking of those rules. You know, it's very, very important. This is a little aside, but it's very meaningful to me for many different reasons. It's over the many years. There is a dharma called Guru Droha that one should never do. Guru Droha means one should never. This is within the whole India culture. But I want to just give an example of this in the Mahabharata, how it supports this. Once you have accepted once you've accepted your teacher as your guru, whatever way that is, like they'll send in India, they'll send a young child when they're 12 to study with their teacher for 12 years, and then they'll come back from that. So there's this guru-sisha relationship that's embedded in the culture. We don't really know about that here. We have it here a little bit. Just respect for our teachers, we have that. But there, it's something very, very important. And so, it's considered a great, great papa to talk against your teacher, to say anything bad about your teacher. It's considered a great, great papa. But now the question comes up, what if your teacher does something wrong? Like, for instance, so there's an example in the Mahabharata. So say you have a teacher who you've learned from, who you've studied from, who you've gained knowledge from. This isn't just Vedanta. In the Mahabharata, there's a very famous archer who was a shastra. He had mastery of archery in the shastra. You know, and I think it's called the Dhanurveda. The Veda on archery. It's not just archery, but it's focused on that. His name is Drona. Drona taught all of the Kauravas and the Pandavas. You know, now these two are in war, and Drona's actually on the other side. He's on the side of the Kauravas for many complex reasons. Of all of his students, Arjuna was his favorite. And Arjuna was the best. Nobody could match Arjuna. And Drona was attached to Arjuna also. And so, at one point, in the forest, there was a tribal guy named Ekalavya. I think that's how you pronounce his name, Ekalavya. And he had no teachers. But I think that he had seen Drona at one point from a distance. And he had in his mind accepted Drona as his teacher. And so what he did was get an image, some image of Drona that he put. He was out in the forest. He was just a tribal. And he put that image of Drona up. And then every day he did his pranams and prayers to Drona. And every day then he would practice. And one day, I think when the Pandavas, I might have be making a little bit of a story up, but it's kind of like this. When the Pandavas were out in the forest, they saw this archer who was doing these incredible feats. Unbelievable, you know. And they were shocked by this, and they met with him, and eventually brought Drona. And Drona met with him and realized how extraordinary he was. And Ekalavya pranamed and did all his prostrations and said at some point, whatever I can do, whatever dakshina may I give, let me give any request that you have. And Drona said, give me your right thumb. And so Ekalavya took off his thumb and gave it to him and did prostrations. What a strange story. You know? And then he went on living his life and practicing his archery and doing his life with the same devotion. Now, when you really sit and analyze the story, and just because I may have botched the story a little bit, you can look Ekalavya up on Wikipedia or something and they tell the whole story. But why I'm telling you this is that why I'm mentioning it here is the laws of Dharma now say that Drona, you know, Drona is in some way a small person. If we were to judge him, if I'm to judge him, I would say there's something wrong there, something small. I don't understand this. How could he do that? How could he do such a thing? You know, to Ekalavya, you know, just to protect Krishna, and there's to protect Arjuna, and there's some talk about it too. I was doing it to protect Arjuna and all of that, you know. But he just does that. He sacrifices this boy who has unbelievable skill, way beyond Arjuna's. He sacrifices him, you know, to protect Arjuna. Okay, and so that doesn't bring a lot of friendly feelings toward from the outsider looking on toward Drona, right? I mean, it doesn't for me. It brings confusion, and it's something that I've had to contemplate on in a very useful way. But what I've understood by that, and maybe others have also understood in one way or another, is that with Dharma, it's what Ekalavya does has to do with what is his Dharma. What Drona does has to do with what is his Dharma. If Drona did something, if the teacher did something that was adharmic, the teacher has to come to terms, whoever the teacher is, or the person is, has to come to terms with that, because no one is beyond the laws of Dharma. You know, the only thing that's beyond the laws of Dharma is the Atma. You know, this body, whether you're a Jivan Mukta, say you're a Jivan Mukta, very mature in your knowledge, know yourself completely, and you stick your hand in fire, you will be burned, you know. Unless you've practiced some siddhi and maybe done 100,000 of a certain particular type of mantra and really prepared yourself to be able to stick the hand in fire and not be burned. If you're just being a normal person and putting your hand in fire, you'll be burned. So you aren't beyond the laws of Dharma, no matter who you are. If you can be the greatest archer, the greatest Mahatma, his behavior or her behavior is still within the laws of Dharma. But that's the teacher's behavior, and that's their dharma, a dharma, and they have to deal with it themselves in whatever way Bhagavan deals with that. Ekalavya has his dharma. And so because Drona, his teacher, is acting in a peculiar way, does that give Ekalavya, the license to break the dharma, his dharma? See what I mean? His dharma is never do guru droha. It's the same. It's easier for us to understand with our parents. Our parents have done all kinds of bad things. I assume all parents have done bad things to their children, wittingly or unwittingly. You know, and then they have to correct themselves and work on that and become better and deal with the problems of that. But because they've done this or that badly, what does that say about your dharma. You know, what happens with your dharma? Is it like an eye for an eye? If they are bad to me, then I have a right to be bad to them. And so if I am bad to them, well, Bhagavan pat me on the back and say, well, you were bad to them because they were bad to you, and even though you're behaving adharmically in this situation, it's, you know, it goes on and on like that. And so there's so many stories in the Mahabharata about this, trying to understand dharma and trying to understand your dharma. Another person's adharma doesn't justify your adharma. The other person's adharma has to be met by you dharmically. That doesn't mean being a scapegoat or anything. It just means, what is my dharma in this situation? Not, he's adharmic, therefore I'll be adharmic. No. What is my dharma in this situation? It took me a while to come to peace with that. Because sometimes I used to feel that isn't, in my own experiences with people, that isn't just. It's like they're getting away with all of this and there's nothing I can do. You know? I can't push back in an equal way. And that's true. You can't push back in an equal way. Because if you do push back in the same way, you will suffer the same adharma. Because I had tried pushing back in an equal way and I suffered the same adharma. It used to really make me angry. Until I finally understood. And then Ekalavya has been kind of a model for me because it's so extreme. The model is so extreme. So anyway, what he's saying in this verse, you know, he says the rakshasas, the one who have a tendency, who fall into a dharma, they flee, and they flee Bhagavan in all different directions. Then he says, sarve namasyanti cha siddha sangaha. But then there's the whole collection of siddhas, those people who are exalted in their dharma and their discipline. All of them pranam to you. All of them pranam to you, namasyanti. And then he says, kasmat chate namaren mahatman, kasmat chate namaren mahatman, kariyase brahmanopyadikaratre, kariyase brahmanopyadikaratre, anantadevesha jagannivasa, anantadevesha jagannivasa, tvamaksharam sarasat tat paramyata, tvamaksharam sarasat tat paramyata. He says, all of these siddhas, all of these highly accomplished spiritual beings are the siddhas, really, like Kapila. There's a list of them who are highly accomplished yogis. You know, all of them prostrate to you. And then he says, and for what reason wouldn't they? He says, hey, Mahatman is the vocative of, it means the one who has a great soul. But when you talk about, say, a jnani as a Mahatma, or a great person here, a great yogi as a Mahatma, when you're talking to about Ishvara as, hey, Mahatman, it means the one whose Atma is infinite, the one whose being is infinite. Mahat means infinite. Huge, big, large. The one who's so for Ishvara, we'd say the one whose Atma is Brahman, the one whose being is infinite, the one who contains everything in himself. So Swamiji, in his translation, he just says, "Oh Lord, hey Mahatman." He says, "Who would not bow down? Who would not? For what reason would someone not bow down to you?" He says, Gariyase brahmanaha api adikartre. He said, you are even the creator of Brahmaji. There is Gariyase. There is nobody better. There's nobody to compare to you. There's nobody on the other side where we have good, better, best. There's nobody better because there is nobody else. There's nobody who's not kind of included in your scope. So there's no other person who is greater. And you even are the adikartra of Brahmaji. Means you are Brahman. When we look at Ishvara as Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, where Ishwara, when Ishwara projects as the creation, we say that's Brahmaji. So here it says, you are the karta, you are the very cause of Brahmaji itself. So you are there even before the creation is Brahman. You are the self from whom the creation comes. So if we look at Ishwara as Brahmaji, means Ishwara as the creator, Vishnu Ishwara as the creation being sustaining, and Ishwara resolving the creation as Shiva, Brahma Vishnu Shiva. All of that is just Ishwara. But Ishwara, that Maya, Brahman, the conscious being which is infinite, you know, the self that you are, from that Brahman, this creation projects, Brahmaji, is sustained and into that resolves. So you are the one who is there because of whom Brahmaji comes. So you are the very self, the very karta, the very creator, the one who is the cause of Brahmaji, Brahmaji being the Ishwara manifesting in the creation. So your form, he says, hey Ananta, your form is Ananta, without end. Anta means end, Ananta means without end. So your form is Ananta, it's Devesha. You are the Lord of all of the Devas. If you look at the Devas as, Deva means that which conscious being, luminous being. But when we look at the whole creation as being an infinite display of laws or a display of infinite order, each law is a Deva, is considered as a Deva. Because no law is away from Ishwara or separate from Ishwara. And so if I were to single out all of those laws and then personify them, I would call that the personification of that law a deva. Like, for instance, as he'll say later, Agni is the devata of fire. Agni also means fire. Varuna is the devata of water. So all of the laws that apply to water fall under Varuna. So Varuna really encapsulates all the laws that have to do with water. Agni encapsulates as a personification of all of the laws that govern fire, like that. So all of the laws that govern the wind is Vayu. All of the laws that govern death are Yama, or Yama, or Mrityu. So like that, you can, if you think of a law, you can name it as a devata. Like, for instance, if I say fire, what would the name of the devata? Agni means fire. So what would the name of the devata be? Agni. There's also many, many names for fire. Many names. But so if Agni is fire, then what do we call fire? That's Lord Agni. That's the Agni devata. So we just say, let's give him a name, Agni. What about water? There's the water. Who's the Lord of water? So Varuna is for water. Who's the Lord of water? Varuna is. You see what I mean? So now say there's some, you think of wood, who is the Lord, or Vriksha, who is the Lord of the trees, of the Vrikshas? Vriksha. And they'll have other names too, you know. But anything that is there has a devata, has laws that are holding it together. So if I want to personify those laws or give those laws a name, because no law is apart from consciousness, then I call that those laws a devata, and I evoke, you know, I evoke that devata. Like, for instance, you can evoke the devata of a certain species, like the devata of all mice. You can evoke the mice devata and say, if you stay here in my apartment, oh mice, Tibby will get you. Please go. you evoke the Lord of the mice. I'm absolutely serious, because now remember, all of the mice, or all of the dogs, or all of the cats, they are the same. You know, they follow certain laws, a certain order. All humans follow certain laws, a certain order. And so in India, they will evoke those through a devata. There's thousands of devatas, you know, and Swamiji's even said, you can make up your own devata. A devata for any law that you want to evoke, you can give that law a name and evoke it. Because the law is there, the devata is there. That's the idea. So really, the number of devatas are infinite. When you chant Rudram, it says, you know, Sahasrashah, the Rudras, I mean, they have Rudra, the Lord Rudra, and then they have the Rudras, which are in the thousands. Thousands means countless. When they use thousands upon thousands, they mean countless. So there's Rudra, evoking Ishwar in the form of Rudra, and then evoking all of the Rudras. That means, like if you have the sun, and then the sun's rays are infinite, there's Rudra, but then the reach of Rudra is infinite. And so the laws, the Rudras, become infinite like that. And so here he says, you are the Lord of all of the Devas. Means you. There is no Deva that isn't part of you, that doesn't fall within your scope. So you're Devesha, you are Ananta, limitless. These are all vocatives. O Ananta, O Devesha. Jagannivasa. Jagannivasa means the one in whom the whole world dwells. Nivasa means a dwelling place. You are the dwelling place of the world. Means the whole jagat, the whole creation, exists in your being. You are the sat-chit, the conscious being, which is the home base of the entire creation. Just like if you have a dream or an imagination, your being is, you are the jagannivasa of your dream, right? Or the jagannivasa of your imagination. If I ask you to close your eyes and imagine a universe, that universe is held by you. You are the jagannivasa. You are the one in whom this whole thing is dwelling. So that's what how Arjuna is addressing Krishna now, saying, you are ananta, you are without end. You are the Lord of all of the devas. You are the jagannivasa, the one who is the very being, the very one in whom the entire universe has its dwelling. Tvam akshuram, you are akshuram. Akshuram means you don't perish. Akshara means you are immutable. You are changeless. Nothing ever happens to you. As he's watching this Vishwasarupa, this Virat, he's seeing Arjuna's, cosmic form. He's seeing all of this life, all of these things coming and going, all of this birth and death, and all of this violence, all of these things taking place in Krishna, who is not changing at all. He remains exactly the same. Akshara means nothing happens. You're immutable. Immutable means how to relate to it in your own experience. There is a part of you, yourself, which is immutable. It means you're having so many experiences. All of these experiences, good and bad, some excruciatingly painful, some depressing, some agitating, some blissful, some every type of experience, every type of perception is something that's continually taking place in you who are immutable. So in your experience, that includes subject, object, yourself and your experience, the self in which all the experience is taking place is immutable. And he's seeing that now in reference not to only the Jivatma, which we have to see just in reference even to our body, mind, sense organs. He's seen it in reference to the whole Virat, the whole infinite Swarupa, the infinite form that Krishna is showing him. He's seeing that and at the same time seeing Krishna's being not changing, being Akshuram. And he says, seeing that, then he says, Sud Asat, you are both the cause and the effect of all this. Sud means that which you're perceiving in this case. Asat means that which is not perceived. Sud can mean existence and non-existence. It can also mean all of this that is manifest. And all that is manifest comes from what is unmanifest. And so you are both the effect, all of this creation that's I'm perceiving, and you are the very Asat. And that asat, that cause, is param. Param means it is infinite, not subject to any type of limitation. Remember, param means that desha kalavastu aparichedaha. Your being is not limited in any way. It's not limited by space. It's not limited by time. It's not limited by objects. All of these are coming and going within you, but you yourself are not limited by any of them. So if you think yourself, the being that you are is not limited by space, it doesn't mean you're big or small. It means that space doesn't define you in any way. If you remove space from your being, then your being simply is. It's not big, it's not small. It simply is, because big or small means there's a right and left, there's an up and down, there's duality then. Consciousness is not spatial. Consciousness is, but it's not big or small. And it's not subject to time. Everything in the creation is subject to change, and so therefore subject to time. Change can be marked. Right? Without change, there's no time. Right? You require change for time. But that which is the self, the very consciousness that illumines time, is itself free of time. And so therefore totally free of change. That's why akshatam. No, there's no coming and going for your being. Your being is akshuram. It's changeless, timeless. And you're not subject to any type of a quality. Like if I look out just with my sense organs of what I'm experiencing in the room, there's an infinite display of qualities. You know, chair, leather, black, brown, you know, rug, wool. Everything is textured. Everything has qualities. Qualities in different colors, different textures, different sizes, different emotional qualities. Endless display of thingness, of things and their qualities. That's the vastu. Mm. Consciousness is not a thing that can be differentiated from another thing. Consciousness is the self of all things. If it's the self of all things, it can't be delineated by any one thing. See, if I am both this body, mind, sense organs, and the rug, and the wall, and space, and you, then my being can't be attached to any given thing, right? And so if my being is free, spatially, it's not limited by space. So it's limitless in reference to space. If it's not bound by time, it's limitless in reference to time. If it's not bound by quality, it's limitless in terms of quality. So what it means is, it's not that this is big or small, that would be limited by space, right? That would be spatial then, you know? If it's infinite, if we can't say it lasts forever, because that means it's ongoing. It's free from time. And so it's not going, ongoing, it's not going, it is the present, the changeless present, which is, in fact, all you ever experience. The changeless present is the presence of your being. You have nothing to do with time. Time takes place in you. You are free of time. And so, Arjuna, even though he's still experiencing this duality, he's still experiencing duality in that he's got his own ahankara. Now, here I am, Arjuna, experiencing Bhagawan. And he's experiencing Bhagawan beautifully, except he's leaving himself out. Right? So he has this paroksha jnanam of everything, this indirect knowledge, in a sense, of everything that that Krishna is showing him, but at the same time not recognizing, I am that. And so he's quaking. And so then he says, Pramadi deva purusha puranaha. Tvamadi deva purusha puranaha. Tvamasya vishwasya param nidhanam. Tvamasya vishwasya param nidhanam. Vetasi vedyam cha param cha dhamma. Vetasi vedyam cha param cha dhamma. Tvayatatam vishwam anantarupa. Tvayatatam vishwam anantarupa. He says, Tvam Adi Devaha. You are the Adi Deva. Here Adi Deva means you are consciousness, conscious being, and you are Adihi, the first. Adihi means the first. You are the cause of everything, and you are consciousness. There's nothing before you. So you are both Adihi, the first means nothing before you, and you are Devaha, you are self-luminous consciousness. So you are Adi. Tvam Adi Devaha. You are Purushaha. Here the meaning of Purushaha, there's different meanings. The one that Swamiji takes, Shankara says in the commentary, the one who abides, this is common meaning, purishayanat, the one who is abiding, sleeping, being in every puri, in every city. The body is the city. So the one who is abiding there in every city, Another meaning, though, is the one who pervades fully everything. So the one who is, has the sense of all pervading everything. So the Purusha. Purana is a word that's always used also. It means the one who is Pura, very ancient, but Navaha, ever new. So the self doesn't age. If you go back 1,000 years or 1,000,000,000 years, it is new. If you go forward 1,000,000,000 years, it is new. So the self, because the self is free from time. So he says, you are Puranaha, you are ever fresh, you are ever the same. Even though ancient, ever, Swamiji often say for Purana, you're ancient but ever fresh. Ancient but you haven't aged. You're ancient, you've been here forever, ever, but you haven't grown old. So you're Puranaha, ancient but ever new, Puranaha. Tvam asya vishwasya param nidhanam. You are asya vishwasya, for this entire universe, param nidhanam, the ultimate point of resolution. In other words, the whole universe comes from you, is sustained by you. You are the Jagan Nivasa, the one in whom the whole universe rests. But the whole universe also resolves into you. You are its point of resolution. You are its truth. You know, you could say like, just like if you have a dream, the dream comes from you, but the entire dream also resolves into you. So you are the resolution. You are the point of resolution, and you are the very being that is the truth of the whole creation. The creation comes from you, and you are its point of resolution. Then he says, Veta Asi. You are both the knower, Vejimcha, and the known. And so now, when Arjuna is looking out at this whole Virat Swarupa and seeing everyone in it, he's seeing all of this as Ishvara. Right? And so everything is you. He's seeing it clearly. There's nothing here that is not Vejim. Everything here that is known is you. You are Krishna, Ishvara, the conscious being. Therefore, as the Sakshi, the knower of this whole thing, but this is you also. There is nothing that is known that is not you. This whole infinite creation is your form, is Virat. This is your form. So everything that is known is you, and you are the consciousness also because of which it is known. So you are both the Veta, the knower, as the Sakshi, and the Vedyam, that which is known. And you are the Param Dhamma. Now here, Param Dhamma is different than Nidhanam. Dhamma is an abode or a place that you would, a place you desire to go. So like, if you want to take a vacation and you have to choose a vacation spot, that's the Dhamma, that you're desiring to go there. Or say you have a fantasy about a place you would like to live, you want to build a home in a particular city, that's your dhamma, that's your abode, that you would love to be there for as long as you like to be there. But the param dhamma is that abode which is param. There is no greater abode. It's the abode that does not change in terms of your desire for it. So the param dhamma really is the atma, it's moksha. You, the Ishvara, is the param dhamma. Because as the Atma, as Brahman, because the Atma is the very source of Ananda. And so for every other Dhamma within duality, you have to project Ananda upon it and then seek it. But at some point, you'll tire of that particular space or place or situation. And then the Ananda is withdrawn from it, and then it's just a place, you know, like every desire. You have a desire for it, you fulfill the desire, and then after a while that thing has to go to the St. Vincent de Paul, or, you know, to the garbage or wherever. But there was a time when it was holding Ananda for you. The whole creation. I can say, I want to go here, or I want to go to Swargaloka, I want to go to a heaven world. Or I want to live here, or I want to go there, or I want to be in this particular abode. But in the end, those abodes are away from, in a sense, their source, because you're looking outward. So the real Dhamma, the Param Dhamma, is the Atma, which is the very source of the Ananda that we see. So he says, you are the Param Dhamma. Toya, and then he says, Toya Tatam Vishwam Anantarupam. Hey, Anantarupa, he addresses Krishna and says, you whose forms are limitless, means endless, Ananta, without end, because there is nothing that you experience that is not Ishwara. This is Ishwara. There is nothing that's away from Ishwara. So now Arjuna has really understood this, all of this, everything that's being experienced is you, is Ishwara. But that's what he's saying, is you. Everything, all of this is you that I experience. He says, this entire Vishwam, the universe itself, is tatam, pervaded by you. Tatam means pervaded. Toya tatam Vishwam. This whole universe is pervaded by you. Hey Anantarupa, you whose forms are limitless, this entire universe is pervaded by you. And what Shankara makes clear in his Bhasha, don't think that it's pervaded by you like space. Because space is different than what it pervades. Space, air, fire, water, earth, it's just one of the most subtle of the elements. It's not that you pervade the universe like space. You pervade the universe as its very being. Like the pot, like the clay pervades the pot. Or like water pervades the ocean. Right? You pervade this universe like water pervades the ocean. And does water pervade the ocean? Because there is no ocean without water. I pulled the water out of the ocean, there's no ocean. But then you can say, you can use that language that water is pervading the ocean. Or the pot, from the standpoint of the clay, of the ocean, you can say water pervades you. Or you could say you are nothing but water. So here when he says, you know, you pervade this entire universe, Shankara goes a little further to say, this is what he really means by that. You are the Sat-Chit, you are the very being, the consciousness, which is the very self, the very substance of this universe. Like what if I were to say, I pervade my dream. Well, that's true from the standpoint of the dream, or I pervade my imagination of a meadow. Say if I have an imagination of a meadow. From my standpoint of the conscious being, I wouldn't really say I pervade the meadow, my meadow imagination. I would say that that meadow imagination has no being apart from me. I am the very truth of it. You know? But from the standpoint of the meadow, I could say, from within the meadow, talking from the standpoint of the meadow, the whole meadow, all of the trees and the meadow and the animals and the sky and the sun and the clouds, the whole imagination is pervaded by being. The existence pervades it. There is no part of that meadow that is apart from Sat, apart from being. There's no part of that meadow that's apart from consciousness. And you can't pull the consciousness or the being out of it, or the meadow wouldn't be there. So I can talk, it's easier to talk like that from the standpoint of the meadow. But he says, from now I'm looking at this Anantarupa, all of these forms. So he addresses Krishna as, hey Anantarupa, you who have all of these forms, I see that you pervade everything. Everything that I experience is in no way away from you. Your being is present, like the warp and woof of everything I experience. I'll do one more. So then it says,
Prajapatis tvam prapitamahascha namo namaste astu namo namaste astu sahastakritvaha namo namaste astu sahastakritvaha punascha bhuyo pi namo namaste punascha bhuyo pi namo namaste. He says, now having said that you are everything, you pervade everything, you're the very being of this whole creation. Now he says, you are Vayu, the Vayu Devata. Vayu means the Lord of the wind. Vayu is the wind. So the Lord of the air, Vayu. You are Yama, the Lord of death. You are Agnihi. Yama is Lord of death. Agni is fire. Agnihi, you are Agni, means you are the Lord of fire. You are Varunaha. You are the Lord of the waters. You are Shashankaha,
the Lord of the Devata of the moon. You are Prajapati Twam, Prajapati Twam. You are Prajapati, you are Brahmaji, the one. Prajapati normally means Brahmaji. So you are Prajapati, you are the one who creates the whole creation, Prajapati. Vishnu, you are the Brahmaji aspect of yourself. It's called Brahmaji. And you are Prapita Mahascha. You are the creator, and you're the grandfather. You're the great-grandfather of the creator. So you have Pita is the father. Pitamaha is the grandfather. And so Brahmaji is considered the grandfather because Brahmaji gives birth to all of the beings who then give birth to their children. So Brahmaji, the creator, is called the Pitamaha, the great father, the grandfather. But now, Brahman, now Ishwara is being addressed as the Brahman, as Ishwara. You are the one who is the father of the father of the father. You are ultimately the father from whom all of these grandfathers, great-grandfather, grandfather, father come. You are the conscious being. You are the one who is no longer fathered. That's the idea. You are the ultimate father. You are the prapitamahascha. So realizing this, you are the source of all beings. You are the ultimate source of all life and of all beings. So then he says, Namo namaste astu sahasrakrituha. Let there be salutations to you. Let there be, he says twice, Namo namaste astu. Let there be salutations to you. Let there be salutations to you, sahasrakrituha. Thousands in number. It means let there be countless salutations to you. So it's very poetic. Namo namaste, salutations, salutations to you, astu, may there be, sahasra kriptuha, 1,000 times. 1,000 times means countless. Then he says, punascha bhuyaha api, again and even again, namaha namahate, my salutations to you, my salutations to you. Then Swamiji is talking about this. He says, Arjuna is so overwhelmed that he doesn't know how to, there's no way to express it. He can't give enough pranams. He can't pranam enough times. He can't do a namaskar enough times. He can't say thank you enough times. He can't show gratitude enough times. There's no way to express at all, to express the way he's feeling. And so that's what he's saying here. There's no way I can express the way that I'm feeling. So salutations to you infinitely. Okay? And then he goes on. So we'll stop here. Purnamidachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. हरिः ॐ श्री गुरुभ्यो नमः हरिः ॐ
So why can Arjuna see it in Krishna but not in himself?
Because I think it hasn't, the vision hasn't clicked in for him completely, and what he and Krishna, so here's Arjuna, here's Krishna, and Krishna is giving him this vision. So from Arjuna's standpoint, even though he's not seeing it with his eyes, he's being given the vision of Ishvara, not the I am Ishvara, right? So this is exactly like, say, even if you have, sometimes I talk so much about having these meditative experiences. You can have a meditative experience, even a nirvikalpa experience, or an experience of very expansive, incredible, beautiful, divine type of experience. But then, and you know that it's the truth, and you know this is Ishvara, you know that this is God. Mm-hmm. In some form, you just know it because it is. But when you come back from that experience, then you, the jiva, had this experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and how can I have that again? Or, you know, how can I keep that with me always? Mm-hmm. Because the jivatvam is still there. And so for Arjuna, even though he's having this experience of Ishvara, the jivatvam hasn't gone yet. You know, and that's why he can feel so much fright, because he's within it. You know, he's experienced within it, meaning within the subject-object relationship.
So this seems to be a big, that jiva tvam to go, seems to be like such a quantum leap, you know, in gaining this knowledge.
Well, it's everything, right? It's not just a quantum leap.
Yeah.
It's the difference between having knowledge and not having knowledge.
Right.
And what's so interesting is that's why in the Bhagavad Gita especially, which is the whole book is this, it's why it's such a kind of a sacred book for everyone. They talk about, you know, that karma yoga buddhi. The karma yoga buddhi is not the buddhi of a jnani, but it is so close that it's barely distinguishable. But the difference is, for the karma yoga buddhi, and this is the kind of buddhi that Krishna is trying to, you know, unfold here. So if you have that, even though the ahankara is still there, you know, and that sense of kartritvam, doership and enjoyership of, you know, because everything is seen as Ishvara, and you take all of the results of your action as prasad, that prasada buddhi, the mind itself becomes very subtle, you know, and very unencumbered. So there's not very much, there's no rub between your mind and Ishvara. So there's nobody fighting it. And so the mind enjoys a great amount of relative shanti and peace, and is in a disposition that can easily make that transition. As though it's not a real transition, it's not a physical transition, it's a transition of recognition. Mm-hmm. But the mind is already living the life of a sannyasi, right? Because it just your main love object is Ishvara. The relationship that you have, that all beings are included in, is your relationship with Ishvara, because this is Ishvara, you are Ishvara, you are Ishvara. The results of these karmas is Ishvara, you know? And so, and I accept all of those results as prasad. So if you have that prasad, the same prasada buddhi that you have at the temple, you have this whole life becomes prasada buddhi. And then even though you accept this as prasad from the Lord, that doesn't mean you don't go out and try the same thing again a little differently. Mm-hmm. But then you accept that as prasad. And so the wonderful thing about the prasada buddhi is that it doesn't crimp you or cause you to try to circumvent or swallow your desires. It's only if the desires are deemed unhealthy or adharmic or something like that, that's different. But I'm talking about just the natural desires that human beings have. You can have those desires, but accept everything, the results of your actions with that prasada buddhi, the mind still maintains shanti. You know, and that allows the person to grow emotionally, really beautifully, actually. But you have to, for us, and Swamiji does this now too, it's not highlighted so much in these ancient texts, but that prasada buddhi you have to turn inward also, you know, towards your own emotional growth, to your own problems that you're dealing with, toward the whole inner world as well as the outer world, that type of prasada buddhi or that care.
Where's the prasada buddhi for, say, some of personality affliction you have, or some childhood issue that never resolves? How do you see that as a prasada?
We work with it in different ways, okay? So I could be unfolding this in a lot of different ways, but say I'm talking about in terms of how to be with it in terms of prasada buddhi. There, I think, say there's something, a tendency that you have that is, you call it, it's very well-rooted. So it's some quality of mind or some way of reacting that continues to cause you pain, and you continue to work on it. You continue to work on it, and you don't want it to be there, but it's there. It's there, and it's rising its head over and over. So how do you hold that? If you hold that as prasada buddhi, you know, you're working. It's not something you want. You want to change it. But it's not changing, you know. And so how are you going to hold that? It's an unfulfilled desire. It's an internal desire that is unfulfilled.
Yeah.
Like you say, I want my mind to be like this.
And the change doesn't happen.
And you would say, and this time the change doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I accept that as Bhagavan's grace, as prasad from Ishwara. You just take it as Ishwara.
Well,
then again it doesn't happen, prasad. Then again it doesn't happen. You might say, well, I have to try something different. Then it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. Then you say, okay, this is Bhagavan. I accept it. Look at what's the alternative? This is Bhagavan. I don't accept it.
Yeah, then you get irritated.
Mm-hmm. So, but when you're really using the prasada buddhi, it has to do, when we're talking, it has to do with your relationship with desire. And I'll say, you have a desire for something, and so you work for it, and you're going to get a result. But you don't have control over the result. You have some control over the actions you take to produce the result, but there's so many other variables, and it's almost countless variables.
Yeah.
Besides even knowing that your actions, there's a difference. We have these two words, yatna and prayatna. Yatna means you make an effort to fulfill this desire. But the effort could be erroneous. You're making an effort, but that effort would never for anybody result in the fulfillment of that particular desire. So that's yatna. Prayatna is where you make an effort that is appropriate to the desire. Right, and so it would actually, because of the laws and whatnot, it will actually result in that you're making the proper effort. So there's yatna and then prayatna. But then also, there's all of the karma of the situation, you know, that can come in, that even though you've made the proper effort, so many things that you have no control over can go astray. Because otherwise we can say, somebody discovers the proper effort, and then that proper effort will always manifest with the result. That isn't true. There's so many things that can go wrong. And so there's a very famous verse where Krishna says, "Accept you be responsible for the effort, but know that you're the adhikari for the karma, but know that I am, it's the karma pola only comes from me." He says, don't get confused over this.
Well, what if that prasada is the same old flaw, you know? I mean, how do you see that as prasad? I see that as a kind of a cosmic screw up or something, not a gift.
If you take it as, now we're getting into something a little bit different, you know. Prasad de buddhi, take it as the results of your, how you receive the results of your desire. Realizing that they're from Ishwara, there's many more factors involved than you can possibly have control over. And so there's karmas that are far, far reaching, right? Even into past lives. So there's karmas that are far reaching, all right? And so say you accept that. If you're an atheist or whatnot, that's a little different. But say you accept Ishwara, and so then you accept the infinite laws, then there are far-reaching karmas that are result, which are way beyond your control. You know? And so you can only do what you can do. And if you are, for whatever infinite, complex constellation of reasons, your efforts are not able to manifest a result in what you would like, then you just bow down your hilt to Bhagavan and you just accept that. Okay, I have to live with that. How it is. Or you can keep on making efforts, but it doesn't matter. You keep on making efforts, or eventually you quit making efforts in that particular thing, just accept it as it is, you know? And just accept it as Ishwara. You know, we all have so many limitations. I mean, every upadhi, whether it be your mind or your emotional self or your physical self or your sense organs, somebody's much better off than you. Definitely. And it's infinite. All the people that are better than you is infinite. And all the people that is worse than you are infinite. Right? So it's meaningless. But the fact is that what it amounts to, if you say that, if there's infinite better, infinite worse, in every aspect, you know? So then what does that mean for you? Nothing, really. What you have in this particular life, this is what it is this time around. That's why Swamiji says, you know, and I actually, this has been like a mantra for me until it became second nature, which usually is now, not all the time. Be grateful for what you have, because what you don't have is infinite. It's true. Be grateful for what you have. What you don't have is infinite.
Well, you know, usually when you have some kind of downfall, what you call a downfall, you blame yourself for creating that, or you're at fault for having that. That's a mistaken perspective.
But that attitude is one that we're trying to kind of change, because that attitude takes you into a downward spiral.
Right.
But that attitude, once you realize that attitude can be replaced by, you know, another attitude. This is what I have to work with, for whatever reasons, you know. Whatever reasons, this is my lot. This is the hand I've been dealt. And these are the things that I have to work with. You know, so you look at the whole life as a sadhana. All of these things, you know, like in the Bhagavad Gita, so much is attitudinal. Really, what allows you to survive or have a happy life is attitude. Mm-hmm. But to have an attitude, you can't just superimpose an attitude on yourself. The attitude has to be replete with a depth of understanding, so that attitude makes sense in the whole scheme of things. If the attitude doesn't make sense and you don't understand it and it's not in your best interests, really, that you truly understand that it's in your best interest, then that attitude doesn't mean very much. Here, the Bhagavad Gita is for a mumukshu. Right? Karma Yoga and Sannyasa both are for the mumukshu, means the one who has recognized the problem, that this world is by its nature incapable of making me free or full or whole and complete. It only gives spurts of happiness. That's all it can do. It's not its fault. It's its nature. That's all it can do. So say I realize that and I get myself to a teacher. I become a mumukshu and then Bhagavan gets me a teacher. That's his job. He has to do that. If you become a mumukshu, then the creation has to supply you with knowledge. That's the promise of that tradition. Right? That's, you know. And so, then what do you start to learn and recognize more with more and more depth? That everything that you are seeking, the wholeness, the fullness, the being loved, all of it, everything that you seek as a jiva, to be full, to be whole, to be complete, that is the nature of the Atma, of yourself. We project that onto the world and then run after it. That's what we call self-ignorance. Atma jnanam, atma ajnanam. You know? Is that I, not knowing myself, I project those moments of happiness onto an object and run and try to get it then. Where actually the source of all of the wholeness is my being. You know? And my being is the very source of the whole creation. That's the truth of it. So now as I start, as more and more I recognize that, I see it, I know it, I understand it, my logic cannot come and knock up, knock it off. My logic only supports it. You have to, all of your logic, all of your thinking, all of your objections have to be dealt with. Your mind has to deal with them. You know, it's not you, the teacher can unfold all of these logics and all of that, but it means nothing unless your mind says, oh, that's right. There's nothing I can do about that. That's how it is. That is the nature of things. And there's too much, it holds up by the shastra, it holds up. It holds up experientially, and it holds up logically, so that your mind relaxes in reference to that particular thing. So your knowledge becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And as you gain in that clarity, the machinations and the problems of the mind, its limitations, its personality, all of these things become less and less important. You know, like, I try to be as best, the best person that I can be. You know, that's good. If you try to do that and you're falling down all over the place, that's fine. You're trying to do the right thing. And then you're trying to, if your mind is weak in this way, that you're dealing with it and working with it. You know, but that's good enough. It's like being a good enough mother. It's good enough. And you just keep helping and working with it and, you know, giving it a proper environment to mature without having reactions upon reactions. The problem for us is not helping ourselves or others when we've taken a fall of some sort, but then reacting to the reaction. Like, say I make a mistake and I can then try to help correct that mistake, or I can say, I can react to the mistake, oh, you've made a mistake and you are such a stupid idiot that you're making these type of mistakes and you're just not worth anything, you know. And so, I mean, why do you even live? Why don't you kill yourself? You have no idea. I mean, this negative voice can be so vicious. But all we really, that negative voice needs to just go. We have to work on getting rid of that one. And then just, you make a mistake and then you try to correct it. You do, that's it, that's all. That's all it is. You know? And you work with it, and if you have certain limitations, like we all have different limitations, then we have to work with those limitations. Okay, well, why can't you say, you know, I have this limitation and this is how I deal with it to yourself, you know? Or if say you find like you're a business person and you can do this and this, but you're terrible at this, you say, I can do this and this, and I'm terrible at this. Let me hire somebody for this. Or let me get some help for this. You know, I can do this, but I'm not good at that. I'll get some help with this. It's objective. You have to simplify, you know? Because in the end, these things don't matter. Mm-hmm. What matters is your reactions to them. Mm-hmm. They themselves don't matter. And so what happens is we start unwinding and unwinding and unwinding all these reactions to reactions to reactions, judgments upon judgments upon judgments. You know, that just make my life a mess internally. Make my life a mess, what I mean is that they create more and more dukkha. It's like a wrapping myself up in dukkha vrittis. You know, for nothing. For nothing in the sense, nothing means in reality for nothing. For me, I'll have all kinds of reasons and justifications for creating the mess. The messy thinking, you know, negative thinking. But in truth, everything that I am seeking, I am. And the me that is whole, there is no distance between me and whatever vritti I have. Whatever experience I have, I'm the self of that experience. And so there is no distance between me and ananda, or the wholeness and fullness I seek. And in fact, the me that is whole and complete, you know, is not hidden or covered by this messiness that we're getting into. So that takes viveka, but it takes viveka, and then this is a, I mean, these, you know, sadhana chaturshtya, these things have to be, should be even contemplated on. You have that viveka, you know, between yourself. You've exposed to the teaching, so you have discrimination between yourself and the world of experience. But that viveka, so you recognize I'm the ananda I seek, that has to lead to vairagya. Vairagya is that dispassion or that lack of clinging, you know, that Buddhist word that they use, clinging, that I like. You know, you stop clinging to all of these things, you know, whether they're mental states or things that you think that you need to make you happy, they just make your life miserable. You're clinging to them, and you learn, and then as you develop your knowledge, you start, it's not this, that clinging's not worth it. And why am I clinging to this? Why is it making me so angry? Why am I getting so upset? And then you can become more interested in seeing what's going on with you so that you can let it go, rather than what's going on with me so that I can keep that pattern. You'd rather give it up than, you'd rather give up the angst that it's causing, you know, than keep condemning the situation.
So the situation, it doesn't really matter what the situation is in. You're still a conscious being, you're still illuminating whatever
it is. It doesn't really matter what the situation is. It's how you are in the situation. And even that doesn't matter in the end. But we could say relatively, it's not the situation, it's how you are in the situation that's going to create the mindset, the shanti or lack of shanti. That's why we say, you know, that's why Krishna says, don't leave the world, you just stay where you are and see, gain knowledge and let this be your laboratory. Let this be your sadhana. You know, because you've grown up in this world and all the triggers are still here. So let yourself just be here amidst all of these triggers until it's not a trigger. Right? If it's a trigger, then you have to say, why is this a trigger? And the world is challenging. There are some things that are really challenging. And how to be with them. So there's big things like betrayals. You know, or different, those are big words, you know. Betrayals or abuses or things that impact your life in a negative way.
Injustices.
You know, how to bring your knowledge to that, you know, internally and externally. How to be in that. That's why in the Mahabharata, and I'm sure not just in Indian epics, in different books or life situations, you know, the way things, difficult things that are, how can they be handled? How can they be handled in light of your knowledge? So instead of running away from them, to really sit there and see, how, in light of my knowledge, even my internal makeup. What is the best way to be in this situation? It's challenging. And sometimes these books like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, and I'm sure others in all the traditions of the world actually, there's so many stories that are exemplars for these really difficult situations, how people handle them. But now for you it's even different. It's not you, a lot of them that you see there, how they handle them in just in the relative world in a dharmic way. But for you it goes in even a step from there, because you have knowledge of the truth of the whole thing, of yourself. So it's how to handle it in a dharmic, skillful way. That's why in Karma Yoga it's both the prasada buddhi and kaushalam. Kaushalam means that skill to handle the situation. Skillfulness in handling the situation. That's kaushalam. How to be skillful in handling the situation in a dharmic way. That's all part of it, prasada buddhi. So when you're reading some of these stories about great stories or whatever, you can reflect on them and see. And the Mahabharata has so many stories, the Ramayana has so many stories. You really think about it. Especially when I say that, Ekha Lavya, because it's so shocking. You know, it's such a shocking story, but it's there. It's like an expose right in the middle of the Mahabharata. And it makes you stop and think. And there's several stories like that in the Mahabharata that stop you, and then you have to really sit with that. And life is like that. Life has all of these shocking things happening in life.
So you said the kaushalyam is kind of a meaningful way of dealing with the prasada buddhi, or what was the connection there? Exactly?
Well, the prasada buddhi is where you take all the results of your action as prasad.
Right.
But then there's another aspect, and that's called kaushalam. And that's appropriate learning what is appropriate behavior in a given situation. And that takes a lot of maturity, you know, like say you, I can imagine like a person who's a parent. Once my sister said, you know, I wish that I knew what I know raising John, her third one, when I was raising Matt, my first one. Because you mature with experience. Or say you're a teacher, whatever your profession is. Say you're a lawyer. You mature. You gain kaushalam. You gain skill. Say you're in a relationship. You gain skill, you know. Mm-hmm. It has to do with dharma and appropriate behavior, and also knowing how to handle certain situations.
So what you really meant is that kaushalyam and prasada buddhi, they go together in terms of being skill sets to live in this world.
Yeah. Well, as a mumukshu.
Yeah.
All for a mumukshu, all of these are a way of gaining the antakarna shuddhi that's necessary, you know, to be able to really hear this knowledge. And remember another thing that I think can be misleading is that when we say antakarna shuddhi, it means purity of mind. And we can look at that as an, I don't know, some sort of an end. It's not meant as an end. It's meant as, you know, if you have these qualifications as a student, this viveka vairagya, ability to discriminate and dispassion and a desire for liberation, and then you have a certain quietude of mind and being able to hold your reactions, all of these things. These are qualities that are necessary for a student to have the equipoise of mind and the natural relative shanti that is necessary if you're going to sit and listen to this teaching. Because without those, a certain amount of peace or relaxation in the mind, steadiness of the mind, your mind's not available for the teaching. So that's what this antakarana shuddhi is about, that the mind has enough calm demeanor, enough shanti, you know, that it has space and the ability to even hear this teaching. Because for one thing, most people would never be interested in it at all. It's the last, they have many things they need to do and want to do, and that's what they're interested in. It's only a very few people that would be interested in this. And then to have kind of a mindset that would allow you to expose yourself to this teaching over and over and over again, and even to sit for an hour or to contemplate, that's a big thing. That requires a kind of a shanti. So that's what the antakarana shuddhi is for. And the prasada buddhi gives you a relationship with the world that creates a natural vairagya. Right? It creates a vairagya because you're continually accepting the results of the action, you know, as Ishvara. So you're continually in relationship with Ishvara. You know, so the relationship with Ishvara and the prasada buddhi is more important, you know, than the fulfillment of the desire. And you're free to try to fulfill the desire, but it comes into a prasada buddhi. You know, so there's nobody reacting there. It's very close to a jnani, you know, whose prasada buddhi is natural based on knowledge. Here the prasada buddhi for the karma yogi, it's not based upon I am Brahman, it's based upon I am a devotee of Bhagavan, my relationship with Ishvara. But that relationship with Ishvara gives me a mind that is close, so close to just being I am Ishvara. It's just like a hair's breadth and the shanti that's being enjoyed there. So that's very easy to make that shift with teaching. And the shift only comes with teaching. It's not, doesn't come without teaching. Because every experience you have is a mental experience. And one mental experience displaces the previous mental experience. And the ahankara is also itself a mental experience. The ahankara is a vritti describing other vrittis. You know? And the other vrittis it can be describing are all kinds of vrittis, like nirvikalpa samadhi vrittis. The ahankara is then describing these experiences. That's what it does. So the ahankara has to shift from its identification with the manas, with the mind, with the antakarana, to identification with the atma. Means that when the I rises, when the ahankara, when the I thought rises in the mind, it's the self that it's labeling is Brahman, not Brahman plus the emotional state, or Brahman plus the body, or whatever.
I have a question about these negative thoughts. I kind of want to push them away or negate them. But I also read something about what you resist persists. So it's sort of like I don't want to accept them, but then I also don't want them to persist.
Well, it depends on what you mean by accepting them. Accepting means that you're not pushing it away and trying to pretend that it's not there or just slamming them in the closet. Accepting them means they're here and how can I help? Like say you went to Swamiji with you have a problem. And instead of helping you with the problem, he tells you, go in the closet. I don't want to see you till that problem's gone. Don't ever bring that problem here to me. That's what we do to our mind. You know, say you have a problem. No. I don't want to know about that problem. Well, then there's nobody there to help. You could say, okay, this problem is there. What's this about? How can I help? So that's different than saying, accepting, like saying, oh, this problem is fine. This behavior is just fine. It's not fine. it's something that needs some help. But wanting to help it is that's the type of acceptance. You know? And some things that pass through your mind don't require that. They can just be blown away, like some stupid thought comes that you really don't want to engage, and you can just say, I really don't want to engage in that, and it will just go up away on its own. There's many thoughts you have choices over. You don't need to engage, but those don't have a heavy hold on you, you know? You have a choice. You can say no to that thought and no to that thought. And it's very easy. But there's other thoughts that are more persistent, and you can't just blow them off. They need some help.
Yeah, but only bad people have those kind of thoughts.
Right.
Like me.
Yeah, and that's the type of thinking we have to get one step behind that one. That's why even Shankara says in the... Even Shankara says... I think it's in chapter 2. The verse is talking about success and victory and defeat in any given situation. You know, he says you even have to have shamatvam, samatvam, that sameness toward victory and defeat. And he said, and you even have to have that samatvam toward victory, your victory and defeat over your victory and defeat. You even have to have the samatvam toward your lack of samatvam. You know, that's the thing. The final voice has to be the one that's the jnani, who's handling all the others.
So you have shamatvam towards your lack of samatvam.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That's exactly what he says. It's so nice. It's such a precious little sentence. Exactly. Yeah. And also in the Gita, Krishna says, you know, so many times you can be your worst friend, your worst enemy, or your best friend to your mind. Let your mind be the best friend of the mind.
Why does that seem paradoxical to have samadham to your lack of? It's kind of it's a coin, or there's opposites happening there.
Yeah, because if you don't do that, then you're not really doing it, right?
Yeah.
Because the final voice has to be the one that can, you know, be helpful in either situation. And so that one has to be the same toward either situation, not condemning of one or the other, but helpful toward both. Mm. Yeah. All right, we've done our duty tonight.